Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my good buddy. I think he's still stuck down under in the prison colony of New Zealand. His name is Chris McIntosh. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thanks, George. It's good to be back.
Are you in New Zealand? Back.
I am. I've had a couple of trips out, but and they've opened it up for us plebs to some extent until the next Scarion comes along or the next fiasco is delivered upon us.
Yeah, but, exactly.
And in fact, they've just opened up Australia, I think, from tomorrow, I think it is.
Well, I guess at least they're headed in the right direction for the time being, right?
Well, I think, yeah, we can discuss that, but I think it's more variations of, the first strike has done sufficient damage, and the ability to hold together those the restrictions that were in place in the face of the rest of the world not holding those restrictions in place has become evident,
right,
to an increasing majority. And so from a political level, there's a huge amount of pressure. And so, you know, entropy works. But yeah, so I think we just now wait for the next
shoe to drop.
But you know, on that point, I think, and we can talk about this today, I think that the ability to bring forward the next iteration of whatever comes down the pike is going to be that much more difficult than the first issuance was, for a host of reasons. One, purely economic. People are in a more difficult position than they were previously. And so I had an interesting conversation with a gentleman locally here who he runs a gym that I was attending. And prior to the lockdowns and when they sort of first started bringing in, you need to be vaccinated and there's this virus and so on and so forth, we had a few conversations, and I just asked questions, which was intended to simply try to get him to think.
Right.
But there was nothing happening. I mean, it was just, what the health ministry says is what the health ministry says. There was a complete sort of shutdown of any thought process. And then, of course, his business got shut for 6 weeks, which didn't crush him. It didn't, but it impacted him. And he made a comment to me that if it weren't for his landlord that gave him a reprieve on rent, he probably wouldn't have been able to keep going.
Right.
And so, but of course, you could argue that, well, maybe the landlord had the ability, presumably he did, to be able to do that. And not all landlords do have that ability, dependent upon how much they're leveraged and so on and so forth.
But did that at least get the wheels turning in his mind? They kind of crossed that line. You know, I think they crossed that line in the States when they started talking about making this mandatory for kids, where if you're a grown adult, you know, you're a guy like our age, you're like, okay, whatever. You know, if it's going to help me save my job or whatever, I'm not going to bitch and moan about it too much. But once you start having those same, let's say, rules for my five-year-old, now we got a problem there. Now, or at least I'm going to do some more research on it.
Yeah. It's each incremental step moves you further away from the collective believing in your initial step, right? So if your first step is, okay, we're going down this path, you have a certain number, let's just say for shits and giggles, it's 80% of the population. You're like, yeah, that's okay. I can buy that. Haven't thought too much about it, but sounds pretty rational. 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Yeah, okay. And then the next step is not 80%. Maybe it's only 76, 77, right? And so each iterative step,
you lose people.
You're losing people. you're losing trust. And that entire structure actually becomes it's an exponential move, right? Because it compounds on one another. So, for example, this just let me finish the story quickly. So this particular gentleman didn't have any sort of thoughts at all about anything. He was happy with lockdowns until it sort of impacted his business. And then he sort of was like, well, that he wasn't happy about that, right? And then they opened back up, but they opened up where you needed to be vaccinated. And so he lost, he revealed to me, about 27% of his clientele.
Right.
Who were like, yeah, we're not, you know, we come here to be healthy. we're not going to take something that doesn't seem to be healthy necessarily. So we're out. And so he lost a certain portion of his sort of business clientele in the first lockdown. Then when the mandates for the vaccination were required to go and attend the gym, he lost another, call it 30%. Now, I don't know how much he lost in the first sort of iteration. Maybe it was 10%. But now he's on a business that's roughly 40% worse off. Now, if you think about most businesses, a pretty good business is running at about a 30% margin. You know, obviously all businesses are different, but you know, so if you just run it on those numbers, you're like, holy shit, this guy's now on the brink.
And with a gym, the majority of your costs are fixed too, FYI.
Yeah, fixed cost, variable income. Yep. And you know, it's like I pay weekly. I mean, I can just turn it off tomorrow. So so there's that. And then I think it's his parents-in-law are farmers. And there's a huge issue here where they're trying to consolidate the power of water distribution. It's something called the Three Waters Project. The long and short of it is that they want to centralize all the distribution of water, no matter where it comes from, even if you've got your own bore, if you've got your own collection tanks, you name it. And this has got farmers up in arms, partly because the way that they're trying to constrict, for example, cattle, right? Because they made this, you know, cows are bad, they fart and they burp, and, you know, it's clearly worse than motor vehicles, which is, I think, anybody that, you know, I haven't spoken to anybody who actually thinks that makes any logical sense at all. But nevertheless, so this has had, that particular initiative is a completely failed initiative in the country, whereas the vaccination side of things was not. The vast majority of people were like, yeah, we're cool, jab away, hit me up, brother. But this is a completely failed initiative. And so I keep bringing this up. There's so many elements that are being utilized in this war that is being waged by the neo-Marxists. You know, there's the health kind of category, if you will, which then ties into contact tracing, surveillance, and everything else. And then you have the other elements which are predicated on climate change, the reduction of meat consumption, things of that nature. There's many. Those are two kind of core ones. And many of the people that are in the farming community, and this is a huge farming country, everybody is related in some shape or form to farming. They're completely against that. And so with that now being this huge issue, he's sort of going, well, I don't trust these people. That doesn't look right. And his parents-in-law are up in arms and they're pissed off about it. And you see signs everywhere here. Huge big banners up, and it tells me that it's a failed initiative, because not once have I ever seen them graffitied or pulled down. Whereas when you had the vaccination type of thing, there were people who put up signs saying no to vaccination. Often it was like people had crossed out the no, or they pulled down the sign. So there was conflict on that topic. This topic, zero conflict. Everybody's
in reality, it's even more conflicted.
Correct. So what with this particular guy, he's now like, he's not trusting. And all I did was I just led him to the United Nations sustainability agenda. And he's like, what's that? I'm like, well, that's the Three Waters Project. Oh, okay. And that now he's sort of opening up his eyes because he's gone and he's looked at some of this and he's like, huh, this has got a whole lot of health stuff in it. And it's got climate change. It's like, this just seems weird. It's like everything that I've been seeing for the last 2 years is it's all there. What's going on? So, you know, again, each iteration, what you're bringing in is different components, all of which are part of the same puzzle. And your individuals don't necessarily need to know the whole piece. All they need to know is a certain element that they don't trust. And once you don't trust at one level, you will not trust at any other level, right? If I, in business with you, diddled you somehow, right? You would not trust me on any other issue ever. Like, you'd be like, you're an untrustworthy guy. You just stole money from me or whatever it is, right? So it doesn't matter what I do on every other issue. I could be the stand-up guy and I could whatever. It doesn't matter. You've broken that trust. It's gone. And then every other thing you're going to look at will be with some level of skepticism. And that's, I think, that's the seed at an individual level that is working in our favor. When I say our, I mean libertarians and freedom-loving individuals. Because it's coming through on multiple levels now, whether it be, you know, rights about, you've been in the United States, you know, it's really, you know, super heated over there on many of these elements. And so then, of course, you've got the energy crisis. So people are in a heightened state of anxiety, which they, you know, when you're in that heightened state of anxiety, you're looking for solutions. You're also looking for people to blame. Okay. And so the ability of for this narrative to be put forward whereby, well, they're saying that's Putin's fault, it's really not working. I mean, I'm seeing that a gas station down the road. You know, and this is just, you know, some chick who works behind, she's like 20 something years old. Presumably doesn't have any, you know, higher education. Not that I think that is particularly useful anymore, but you know, talking about the fact that it cost me like $200 to put gas in my car. And I jokingly said, oh, it must be Putin's fault. And she just laughed and she's like, no, this government's so fucked. You know? And so again, there's a level of trust that's broken. I can tell straight away. She doesn't trust the narrative that's being told to her. She's like, I work in this. I don't know how she's got to that particular point, but she can see there's something not right behind this. Probably partly because a whole lot of this started coming through before Putin invaded Ukraine. So again, you're getting all of these, there's that, then there's the three waters, then like each element of society that they're trying to constrict and control and centralize requires them to impact people's lives at that level. And some people are more impacted than others. If you're a farmer, you go, water, yeah, this water comes out the tap and it comes from the local state government and whatever, and you don't think about it. If you're a farmer, it's absolutely crucial because you've got to feed your livestock. And now if you're being told that you can't utilize the same levels of water, you've got to reduce your water consumption by 20%, you have to reduce your herd size. And if you reduce your herd size, you've got a farm. Your OPEX is what it is, and your CAPEX is the same. You've got fixed costs, as like similar to the gym. So you're now having people going out of business or would potentially go out of business if they implement this and they roll through, which they're trying to do. So people there are completely like, no, we don't trust this government. They might still be triple, quadruple vaccinated, right? But what's interesting, and I'm seeing this now coming through, is where that requirement to now get your fourth booster comes along. There's a way less participation rate. And we can argue about why that might be. Maybe it's just like they just realized, you know what, I've already had it. Like triple vaccinated, I got sick anyway. Like, you know, what the hell is a fourth booster going to do for me? It doesn't make sense. But a certain element surely will be that level of trust in that government and the authorities and the narrative that is being put on them across multiple sectors. So they're in the farming community. They're really pissed off about the fact that probably or might lose their farm as a consequence of these initiatives. And so, you know, they just don't like these people anymore. They don't trust them.
I think kind of what I'm hearing is that these, let's just say the global elite influences certain politicians. I'm not going to sit here and say that this is all their master scheme and they're twirling their mustaches behind closed doors at the Davos meeting, maybe to some degree. And
with a cat on their lap.
What's that?
With a cat on their lap.
Yeah, Bigglesworth. Yeah, right. So, but let's just assume they have some influence over these politicians and some people in the media. And it sounds like, and I've heard this from a few people, that maybe they've just pushed too far. And now we're seeing some backlash, which for those who value freedom, liberty, and free market capitalism would be something to find, or something to be optimistic about, I guess. And so what I want to do on that, though, is I want to kind of transition into kind of investment ideas around this kind of thesis of bigger government and a more maybe globally, I don't want to say a one world kind of global government, but the Davos types trying to push this agenda through the politicians and the mainstream media, which they influence to a heavy degree. So if you're an investor, you say, okay, I don't like it. In my personal life, I'm going to push back against the authoritarians as much as I can. But for my portfolio, I want to set it up in a way that's going to benefit from them pursuing these insane policies or trying to push this crazy authoritarian narrative. And you touched on it there, I think, with the water rights and what they're doing in New Zealand. But I think you're just as bullish long-term on commodities as I am. I've been saying that I think we're probably in one of these 10 to 15 year super cycles like we saw from 96 to 2011. So, and I know most of the people understand the supply and the supply demand dynamics that are in play right now, but they haven't thought through how the supply side or maybe the demand side could be impacted by these global elites trying to push this agenda. And I know you've given that a lot of thought. So could you share some of the kind of your analysis on these deep dives that you've done?
So if we go back to what you mentioned at the beginning of that, you talked about the impact that these global elites, if you will, have had on politicians globally. I mean, that's something that Klaus has bragged about.
Right.
What I do know, and I've verified this through multiple channels, in many countries, there's been loans being made by the IMF and World Bank to countries with the contingency that they follow world needed to follow World Health Organization protocol.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is a hypothesis I had going all the way back to 2020.
This is now known. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's out there in the public. You can go and look it up in terms of loan on the IMF's website, et cetera, et cetera. So what took place there was essentially a bribe. We'll give you $2 billion.
Right.
You follow these protocols. Now, we can argue whether there was a knowledge that that was a good or bad issue. It doesn't matter. It took place. Certainly, I think there's a certain probability that individual politicians in many of these countries thought and believed it was the correct thing to do, right? And that there was all measures that were being instructed by the World Health Organization and affiliated parties were correct or at least based on basic principles that right. that
we could just put them in the category of that gym owner. Nefarious. You just put them in the category of the gym owner, right? That I'm just going to believe the who and you know, I haven't really put any research into it, so I'm going to delegate my thinking to them.
There was a certain level of trust. Okay, so that's kind of on the sort of intellectual level. Then on the financial level, what have we had subsequently? Well, what it's done is it's decimated countries. Okay, in terms of, so let's just say for argument's sake, Colombia, right? I don't know how much they took. I do have the numbers somewhere, but let's just say for argument's sake it was $2 billion. How much of an impact did that have in terms of GDP? We know across all of these countries, the impact on GDP was many magnitudes of that in terms of comparative to the money that was loaned. And remember, it's a loan, it wasn't a gift. Okay. So purely on a financial side of things, you would look at that and go, hold up a second, that didn't really make sense, purely financially. You can argue whether the lockdown saved lives or didn't save lives or anything else, but purely from a financial perspective, it is obvious that it was a poor trade. You took $2 billion and you wiped out $4 billion or $10 billion, whatever it was in GDP and so on and so forth. So,
and you can, by the way, Chris, you can see it here on the street with the level of homelessness.
Yeah. And so then as a political party or as a political leader that's made that decision, you realize that if you were to continue and do the same thing again, sure, you might get more money and you might get more personal wealth, but what you're sowing the seeds of is massive civil discontent. And in some of these countries, as we're seeing in Sri Lanka now, as we're seeing in Libya, it's not just that we're going to vote you out, it's we're going to torch you.
Right.
There's, I think, 34 homes of politicians in Sri Lanka have been burnt to the ground.
Wow.
And the mainstream media don't like publicizing that because it's basically a warning and a message to the rest of the world. So you've got that sort of taking place. And you know, further to the what we started this discussion with, which was around this level of trust. That trust is being broken at multiple levels. It's why we're seeing this. I believe we're going to have a complete bifurcation in the world into other blocks of interest, right?
Like the West versus the BRIC countries or something.
That's sort of the obvious one. And remember, within the West, there are differing policies and differing opinions. It's not like they're all, you know, collectively down the same path, although I think there is more probably a higher level of shall we say connectivity within sort of Europe, North America, which is Canada and America, tied into the Davos crowd, and they have a pretty firm grip. The United States a little bit less, purely as a consequence of the fact that you have a republic, which is just different to Canada, it's different to the UK, it's different to many of the European countries. Outside of that, you've got the BRICS. Well, we could say it's sort of Russia, China, India, and then you have what is largely called the Global South. And I think what's going to happen, and we're seeing this now playing out, I wrote about it in a weekly, the Global South is going to become the political football within this power play. Because there's actually, from a financial side, George, what we've got is two very, very different systems. If we go back sort of 40-odd years ago, and we go, what's transpired over our lifetime? I'm 45, you're roughly the same age. So over our professional lifetimes, what's really been the major thing that we've witnessed take place? It's been a deindustrialization of the Western world. We've outsourced all of our manufacturing, all the resource extraction, all of those things have been outsourced largely to the, we could call it the East. And then as a derivative of the East, it's been the Global South, which is Africa, Latin America, South America.
Okay.
And the way that's been held together by the hegemonic power, predominantly in the United States, has been, as John Perkins mentioned in his book, and readers or listeners might be fully aware of the Economic Hitman. Mm. And if you haven't read it, I'd strongly suggest it. And John talks about how these sort of quote-unquote non-governmental organizations have influenced third world powers, basically to indebt them, turn them into serfs, and extract the resources and the wealth for the benefit of the hegemon. Now, that structure has been changing over the last 10 odd years to the effect where China's basically been doing the same thing with massive Chinese loans. And I've shown this before in writings. So Chinese loans into Africa now way exceed those of Western powers,
right,
for building railroads and infrastructure and everything else. So there's an economic play that's been taking place or under our eyes, and no one's really paid too much of attention to it. But I believe we're now moving into a time where those cards get played. So if you think about the two economic systems, we've had this deindustrialization of the West, which has largely been supplanted with a financialized economy. Everything's become financialized. That at the same time, we have in the BRICS, this industrializing, I kind of call it industrial capitalism, with socialistic tendencies. So many of these countries still provide and increasingly provide social services, whether it be transportation, healthcare. They're kind of moving down that path that we the West kind of began coming out of World War II, you know, providing a lot of what we would determine to be basic necessities, you know, healthcare, transportation, roading, things of that nature. And those are very often provided by the state in Eastern countries. In the Western countries, a lot of that's all been privatized. We can argue things are just, it's not that one is good and the other's bad. They're good at times, but then everything often tends towards extremes. And so where we've privatized assets in the Western world, that privatization has now reached a point where it's been consolidated into the power, into the hands of few, which is how we have essentially oligarchs, whether it be your Gates, Bezos, Zuckerbergs. You know, that there's been a concentration of assets and resources and power post that privatization, which will often swing you back to the state owning things. Mm. And you can go through, you can go through cycles of this sort of taking place. But as we sit today, we've got these two economic systems in the sort of BRICS, if you will. It's an industrializing capitalistic society. And people might argue and say, it's not capitalistic. Trust me, you go to China, it's capitalist. They've got certain nuances to their capitalism, but it's certainly not communist. And it's you couldn't really say it's socialist. There's socialist tendencies. In the West, it's a financialized, deindustrializing sort of setup. And one where, if you think about these two systems, to retain them, to keep them in play, the Western system is now a very high cost one. It's expensive to maintain because you're not producing anything. You've got all of these things are now rights. They're no longer privileges. They're no longer maybes. Education, healthcare, housing, and all of it is debt financed. And then if you look at the other parts of the world, those things are not at that point yet. Yes, there's roading is provided, for example, but often medical care is not. Housing is not. And it's not debt financed. So these are very, very different sort of structures. In the West, most of those things also are not. They're provided by the government via debt, but they're privatized. Think about prison system. So it's a rent extracting monopoly that has now tended towards providing for the 1% while decimating the vast population and their ability to earn an income and everything else. So that's kind of the structure that we're sitting with. And now we're seeing these two economic systems clashing with one another, I think.
Why is that bullish for commodities? Like let's go over the supply side, assuming that we continue down this path. how does that affect the supply side? How does that affect the demand side?
Well, what we've got to remember, George, is that we're coming into this now, as we are, this situation with an absolutely egregious lack of capital spending in the commodity and in particular the energy space.
And why is that, Chris? Because I think this goes back to the Davos types, right, in their narrative.
There are a couple of elements that come into it. We can begin with the easiest one, which is purely cyclical. So if we go back to previous boom, it was 2010-ish. We always have this happen in commodity space. It's an extraordinarily cyclical market. It is very capital intensive.
But has it been exacerbated by ESG and the climate change movement?
So, yeah. But if we go back, so you had this ordinary, typical bear market that came about as a consequence of oversupply. So that was all kind of understandable. But way back 2-3 years ago, we should have seen CapEx spending picking up in a normal kind of environment
cycle.
That never took place. And it never took place because of what you alluded to, which is this political narrative, right? It's the ESG, save the world, the climate Nazis, the, there's been a whole host of political narratives that have made it extraordinarily difficult to bring about additional supply. And that's not gone away, and now it's accelerating. So, you know, right now, as we sit, we just had Sleepy Joe going and asking the Middle East to put on, to bring out more supply. And they basically said, no, now you can, maybe they don't have the supply, which they said they don't, or maybe they just don't want to give the supply. Now there's a geopolitical element that comes into that, but we'll put that aside. The point is that domestically, and this goes to the West, so it's the UK, it's the European Union, it's the United States, it's Canada. The ability to bring on that additional supply requires a level of certainty into the future, right? Because if you're going to go and drill for oil, that's not typically equity financed, right? And the payback period on it is often a decade,
right?
So if you don't have clear visibility, they've literally been telling us that we can't have by 2030 we're going to be fully, or 2040, pick your time. They will come out, they seem to change the dates at any given time, but certainly the trajectory is known, and the trajectory is that we're going to eliminate fossil fuels. So within a short time frame, like they're talking a decade or a little bit after, you know, more than a decade, which in a CapEx spending cycle in the energy space is where you would basically begin to have recouped your capital.
Yeah, right.
So why would you even consider putting down that capital if you had it yourself? And most of them don't. They have to go and finance it. They have to find that capital from investors. So what investors prepare to go and put capital into a project in, I know, somewhere within any of these blocks of the European Union or the North American, the Western sphere, no one's going to do it. So we're stuck with this extraordinary situation, which we've never had before. So in the commodity space, what people need to understand is that the mechanisms that would have brought about additional supply are no longer there, or they're being impeded significantly by legislature and by governments, but not all governments. So, and this is where this becomes very much an East versus West. I mean, I don't want to make it too simplistic, but that's kind of an easiest way to think about it.
Yeah, and also too, Chris, if I could just interject there, I think a good way to think about it is when, if you're an oil company or any commodity company, and you've got this 10-year lag. It's weird because as most entrepreneurs, they think, okay, if I'm selling a lot of product, if I'm selling a lot of widgets, I'm just going to increase the amount of widgets that I'm producing, and let's just make it happen. And next week I'll be producing twice as many widgets, and then I can increase sales, supply goes up. But with that 10-year lag, you're basically investing today for what the world is going to look like from a demand standpoint in 10 years. So if you're that oil, greedy capitalist or whatever Biden is calling them now, why on earth would you invest now if you think the environment in 10 years, the demand is going to go down, the politicians are going to increase your taxes, all of these things lead to you taking that capital and allocating it to other things such as buying back your shares. It doesn't lead to a rational decision to invest in creating more supply.
And it goes more than that, because right now we have this energy crisis. Everybody can see it. Everyone's experiencing it. I just had power just went out for a few minutes. Hopefully that's not one of it. But but this is now a common occurrence in developed world markets, right? And so they're telling us that the solution to this is going to be renewables. So from an investment standpoint, the way that we look at things, because like the most robust portfolio that you can have is one that has natural hedges within it, right? So that because we don't all know what's going to happen. There can be all sorts of events that take place either at a company specific level, an international level. So a certain country could come up with a profits tax, for example. Mm-hmm. Okay, that can impact that particular sector. So you want to have, as best as you can, a robust hedge portfolio, which you will make changes as new information flows come forward. But so if we look at what they're telling us, aside from the fundamentals, and the fundamentals are that we need to have fossil fuels if we're to continue even just half of the things that we want and need in the world. That's just the reality. They're telling us that we're going to use renewables. And if we look at the renewable side of things, I watched a presentation from, I think it's the energy minister in Australia, who was putting forward this idea that, and they were heralding this particular project in South Australia, which is a huge battery operation that helps to fuel a certain amount of electricity. And so we went in and I had a look at that. It's called the Hornsdale battery. And this is just, I'm going to give you this story because it's indicative of what's taking place across much of the Western world. So this is being heralded as the answer to our prayers, right? We can get rid of fossil fuels and we're going to utilize renewable energy. So it's going to use this Hornsdale battery. Now this thing it can power 6,500 houses in a day. There are in South Australia something like 760,000 houses. So that's 0.85% of the homes in South Australia. That this is not 1%, right? 0.85%.
Right.
But South Australia uses about 300 gigawatts per hour of electricity per day. And homes only account for 30% of that. So the 0.85% is actually way worse. And it worked out that if you were to power South Australia with this quote unquote renewable energy, you would need 230 Hornsdale batteries. Now you go, what goes into a battery? So when you go and you look at what goes into these batteries, you realize that we need to be mining the shit out of the planet to get the lithium, the cobalt, the copper.
Right.
Okay. And then when we look at that supply side, we realize that we're massively underinvested there. Because again, in this woke Western narrative, you can't get a copper mine up and going. You cannot get a lithium mine going. You cannot get cobalt, even if you had the cobalt in your country, and not all countries do. So we have an extraordinary situation whereby you can hedge your portfolio for both outcomes. And both And the outcome that we will have is a massive energy crisis, which we're only just beginning now to step into. So you can, we're either going to utilize renewables and we're going to go down that path and there'll be trillions of dollars or billions of dollars spent on it. It won't solve the problem because it cannot solve the problem. We've never, ever gone from a more energy dense medium to a less energy dense medium in the world. Right. And that telling us that we can and we will and we should, that's going to have catastrophic consequences, not just in energy, but across all the way through the supply chain in terms of agriculture, you name it. So again, when you come to portfolio construction, it's we have insufficient supply in not just fossil fuel side of things, but also in the quote unquote renewable space. And then at the same time that this is taking place, we have this global bifurcation, right? With these two systems that are clashing, where, you know, what I think it was Michael Schellenberger, he gave a presentation to Congress, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago. And he, before anyone doesn't know who Michael Schellenberger is, he used to be a real green advocate for years and years until he realized that it's doesn't work and it's nonsense and the real answer is nuclear, and he's become a massive advocate of nuclear power. And he gave a presentation, I think it was in front of the Congress, about 3 or 4 years ago, and he nailed it. He said, this narrative that's being brought forward, one of ESG and getting rid of fossil fuels, if we are to try and push that on emerging market nations, it's not a matter of your living standards falling, it's death. People will die, and they will not take this. And what it will mean is war. So if you keep pushing it, you will go to war. And here we sit today, and that is exactly the trajectory that we are headed down. But what's happening, and this was probable, was that a lot of these countries that are in that space will have to make a decision. Do they stay with the hegemon? And the carrot in that space, coming back to what John Perkins talks about, has been IMF loans. It's been credit, which is now unbacked.
In other words, dollars. They got a dollar lender of last resort.
Exactly. But that is increasingly backed by bankrupt entities. And what we're going to see from the other side is a power play, right? Because this is a political and geopolitical vacuum that's opening up. On the other side, and we just saw, I just wrote about this. So Putin, for example, just met with the Senegalese president. And what did he offer him? Because remember, Africa is a net importer of food. They're going to be probably the hardest hit in this crisis. They are. Okay. So what did he offer him? He offered him grain, food. He doesn't need to offer him paper script. And you can bet your ass that that offer came with contingencies. And those contingencies probably were something along the lines of, if you go and trade and you take certain obligations with the IMF or the World Bank, then your grain gets cut off. Don't play with them, come play with us. Right. And just as in the same way as an IMF loan today will come contingent upon being upon sanctioning Russia. Right. That's going to be one of the things. No, you sanction Russia. But now you've got a problem for the Senegalese who have historically gotten most of their food from Russia. So now they go, OK, well, I've got paper. Cool. But now I'll go buy the food. Where do I get the food? So
And let me just back up there. They would buy the grain from Russia with dollars.
Yes.
That's what gave the dollar value, is that you would need it to settle the transaction with Russia. But if Russia is cutting out the dollar, essentially, then that country or countries, then they no longer have the need for dollars, or even if they need dollars for other things, they would prioritize the food, because at the end of the day, that's what keeps the masses at bay. Once people can't put food on the table, that's when you go from just maybe not being reelected because people are pissed to them taking you out back and shooting you.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And so that's the situation that we're in today, George. And it makes investing extraordinarily difficult, but it also makes it more asymmetric.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
As you were saying that too, Chris, I was thinking about when you're talking about moving to a world where we're using more renewable energy, ironically enough, to get from A to B, we have to use far more commodities and we have to use far more fossil fuels, ironically, to get to that point. When, one example is one of the last times I interviewed our good buddy, Art Berman, he was talking about the amount of diesel that goes into building a wind farm. And people just don't think that through. if you want to build all these wind farms, or if you want to build all these batteries, or if you want to produce all these electric cars, et cetera, that's all fine and good. But that's going to take a lot more fossil fuel than we are producing right now. And to your earlier point, it's going to take a lot more copper, a lot more lithium, a lot more cobalt. So, either way, pick your poison, commodity prices go up.
And when you go down that, when you look at all of these things that need to be constructed and you go down the various elements that go into that construction, you can see the supply and demand dynamics of each individual commodity. And then you can highlight those that have more asymmetry than others. As you well know, one of our key things has been coal, because you just mentioned wind farms, right? Wind farms take a shitload of steel,
right?
And you can't make steel without coking coal. So, and coal is the absolute devil. I mean, nobody wants coal. Coal's just like, you would be more popular if you beat babies with baseball bats on a weekend than if you invested in coal, right?
Yeah, so, but what's interesting about that though is there is a line in the sand where even today's politicians will choose to use coal. And that just shows you how inelastic the demand is. You can sit there and talk about how the demand for coal or oil or blah, 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 blah is going to go to zero over the next 3 or 5 years or 10 years. But look at the reality, the proof's in the pudding. When Germany, as an example, is getting short on energy, they've got two bad options. Either go back to coal, or you allow all these poor people to die, basically, or the standard of living to decrease dramatically. And you see the politicians are choosing to mine more coal or to use more coal.
Exactly. Here's the risk. As a politician, if you keep down this Maoist type of path, you realize that you get to a point where you go from just simply being unpopular to potentially not being able to be the guy that retires, steps out of his particular political position and goes and lives on the beach with a few million bucks and in a nice villa. You don't get to do that. You get to then maybe go to that beach villa, but you've got to have private fucking security and high walls around you at all times, because you've stepped across the line. You will be torched. And so politicians will increasingly have to make that choice. And that's where we get real bifurcation. That's where you will see certain countries making decisions that we hadn't, that don't go along with the political narrative. As a point, if we just look, for example, at the last, just over a month, Mexico. So there's a regional summit that the White House was holding, which for South and Latin America. And the Mexican president refused to attend. His argument, if you will, was that it wasn't fully represented by South and Latin America. Why? Because Venezuela and Cuba were not invited. Now, if you go and you look at some of the politics in this place, it's not like the Mexican government are massive friends with either of those countries. So you go, well, what's going on? I'll tell you what's going on. They're flexing their muscle because on an international basis, they now have much more power than they did before. Not because Mexico has done anything particularly amazing, although they did refuse to lock down and were one of the only countries that did so. And as a consequence, have had seen massive capital inflows. But despite that, they are relatively stronger purely because the Western world is collapsing. And they're seeing, and they're watching this play out. And then you look, and you look at what they did after that. 2 weeks later, they invited a Russian delegation, and they've, basically said these are our friends. And it doesn't matter whether you think that's a good or a bad thing. That's not my point. The second thing that followed on from that was that Argentina requested to become part of the BRICS. What you're watching is you're watching the global South sitting there going, okay, we were always under the thumb of this economic, political, military structure over here, which was largely the West. Certainly in South and Latin America, they're on the doorstep of the United States.
Yep.
Right? So you, in order to trade, you were reliant upon the US Navy. That's just a reality. Much like in the when the British Empire existed, you were reliant on the British Empire to sanction and allow you to move goods and services around the world. And so that was just the reality. That is now being put into question. And there is a pushback that's taking place. And these countries are kind of having to go, well, how do we play this game? Because on the one side, we're being told that we can't have these fossil fuels, that we should be sanctioning them. We can't have our cattle. You know, cows are bad. Meat production's bad. We're going to have to, how do we do that without pissing off our populace, right? And getting torched and pulled out of the buildings and hung up in the streets. And I'm not trying to be hyperbolic. That's a reality in much of the emerging market world. That is a reality. So how do we do that if we wanted to, or is there another path? And so in many respects, it's not necessarily that they feel strongly they want to do something else, but it's just the pain of doing what they're required or being asked to do is too great.
One quick example of that, Chris, that I'd give for the American viewers or the people in the West to kind of get their head around. Here in Colombia, and I know you've been all over the world and it's similar in emerging markets, I would say if you're driving downtown Medellin, I'm going to go out on a limb and say probably 60 to 70% of the vehicles on the road that you see are motorcycles. Why? Because people can't afford a car. That's why. And so this is the next best thing. And that's why you see people carrying around refrigerators on motorcycles, and it would blow your mind what you can get on a motorcycle or what you can transport on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
In Ecuador, I used to see families of four riding around on a motorcycle where the dad would be driving, the mom would be in the back, and they'd put the two kids like right in the middle. No helmets, of course. What's my point? It's that in the United States, we like to think that just in a few years, everyone's going to be driving around in a Tesla. You know, why not? because everyone can afford a $30,000 Model 3 or whatever it is. That does not play out in Colombia. Now, it might, but it won't for, I mean, at least 20 years, because we're not talking about people going from a Ford pickup truck to just moving to a Tesla Cybertruck or something. We're talking about people moving from a motorcycle, and they can't go from a motorcycle, economically speaking. They don't go from a motorcycle to a Cybertruck. That's not the way it works. They go from a motorcycle to a very, very super cheap car that has a combustible engine. Then they go to a cheap truck that has a or maybe an SUV. And I see this playing out with my employees and Angie and Joaquin as they move up the economic ladder. This is how their transport needs or wants change. Mm. And there is no light switch to go from motorcycle to Cybertruck or Tesla Roadster or something like that.
And there's something else which hasn't these pointy shoe elites haven't thought about. In the emerging market world, the infrastructure is not the same as in the developed world.
Mm.
And so if you the ability to move diesel and gasoline around is easy. It's easy,
right?
So you can get it to outposts all over the place. Like you could go from where you are in Medellin up into the hills there, where behind you, with where all the people have their holiday homes, a weekend.
Rio Negro, Guadalupe. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You can go up there, and you'll find those. You get those little like roadside gas stations, if you will, right? Yeah. What are they? Well, like they're not typical gas station like you'd find in North America or in Europe, but they're still a gas station. And how do they? Well, all it is a bloody tank.
Yes.
So the ability to act, that's your infrastructure that can be shifted and moved all around emerging markets. What the hell do you do with a freaking Tesla, even if it could navigate the roads, which it cannot, but let's just say that it could. You don't have the electrical infrastructure to actually run and do that. So it's a non-starter in the emerging market, which is why it's going to meet such massive opposition, if not from a political level, from the ground level, which will then impact the political level, either by revolution.
And which will create this bifurcation that you're referring to. So how does that bifurcation impact supply of commodities? Because I think just as someone who really hasn't given this much thought, they say, okay, Chris, well, fine. You got Mexico picking Russia or Colombia picking the United States, and they have to make these decisions. But there's still the same amount of supply of stuff, most likely, it's being created for global markets. So what? What's the big deal?
Well, there's not the same amount of stuff being created. So what we're seeing is there's a lot of demand destruction. But with demand destruction, we've also got productivity destruction. So, I mean, lockdowns are a perfect example, right? There's a certain level of demand destruction because people are sitting at home on their sofas, no longer working, and no longer. You didn't have as much driving taking place. You didn't have a lot of economic activity taking place. So that was a certain level of demand destruction. But what the elites don't realize is that all those people not working is productivity destruction.
Right.
Okay. So you have a couple of elements. You've got productivity destruction, certain level of demand destruction. At the same time that we're having monetary inflation, because how do you pay? Again, come back to that economic structure I talked about. In the West, it's a financialized, debt-based, deindustrializing system.
Right.
Okay. Which, if you take it, if you just think about how that works, it's you have to issue scrip, and that scrip has to be accepted, which it still is, but it's not being accepted because of its underlying value. It's largely being accepted because we have a debt-based global system where the dollar is the reserve currency. And so if you come back to emerging markets, it's my belief that they're going to have a balance of payments crisis in the next 18, 24 months. And this is really as a consequence of the liquidity that's getting pulled in the US, right? Whether it be, excess reserves, repos, Fed hiking rates, you got a relative differential now, right? In Europe, Japan, all the other major bond markets in the world, relative to the US, are now in a trouble spot. Mm. So that creates just more
to
demand.
Translate, US being the cleanest dirty shirt because we got higher interest rates, going to suck all the dollars to the United States, or a lot of them, therefore less dollar liquidity for all these emerging markets with dollar debt.
Precisely. And so those emerging markets are in a very, very precarious situation. And they will, some of them were going to have a balance of payments crisis, and they will default. Now, the question then is, how do they come out of that? Well, probably there'll be IMF loans coming at them, right? To get them to go down a certain path. But again, we come back to what we just discussed. It's not, things don't happen in a vacuum, right? There are other players that are looking at the incentives there. So if you just took a typical, take an Eastern African country, which has got huge, huge loans now with Chinese banks in terms of their infrastructure, that has a balance of payments crisis, can't afford the food, et cetera, et cetera. And the IMF come along and go, hey, you know, we're here to help. Part of the problem is that the Chinese banks are also there to help. And they want more control, not less control. And they want and need those resources that are now in short supply.
Can, so Chris, just from a technical standpoint, can the PBOC issue dollar liquidity, or would they still need to source those dollars? Wouldn't they? I mean,
they would still need to source the dollars.
They need to source the dollars.
So we still have a dollar liquidity issue.
Because unless they could give yuan loans. And then if they could give yuan loans, but then the entities that would get those yuan, then they would need to be able to settle for the commodities they need in yuan. So that's why that this bifurcation, again, is so important globally.
And that's where I think, you know, if you look at what was the BRICS and it's now sort of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, what they're looking and trying to do is to actually facilitate trade outside of the dollar system. Now, it's tough to do it at this point in time because you don't have the same levels of liquidity. The trust behind the system is, it's new, so it's not as easily trusted. But to me, that's what it looks like they want to and are trying to implement. And it makes a lot of sense because what it does is it allows you a certain level of autonomy. Mm. And remember, one of the most ridiculous, stupid things that the West could have done was to sanction Russia and to steal their reserves.
Right.
Because what it did was it proved to all these other countries that you didn't own those reserves if you fell afoul of the hegemon.
Yep. Yep.
So again, now you've got all these African countries that have got their dollar reserves, which are now being depleted. But now they're going to be, so you're offered a loan, right? But it has to be paid back in the same dollar reserves that you realize aren't really yours if they say they're not yours.
Mm. Yeah, right.
And right now you need food and energy. And you have some of that, which is why Chinese banks are there in many instances. I'm just using the Chinese as an example. It's not just Chinese. But, you know, if it's cobalt that you have, you now... Units of currency, look, if we go back, we think about it. Global reserve currencies last round about the same time frame that this one has, and we're due for a reset. That's just a historical pattern. How does that come about? We know it always comes about with a lot of turmoil and chaos. So I think there's a decent probability that goods and services start being traded literally for their underlying value. And maybe it's a basket of currencies. Maybe it's even an SDR, right? But it's something other than the dollar. And that in itself means that your facilitation of trade is much, much more difficult, right? Which means that you will have less supply. It's, if you think about the wheels of commerce or the grease that keeps it going, that grease has all been taken away. There's cogs in there. It just gets churned up. Our supply chains are broken. those are the physical supply chains. What we're talking about really sort of are the monetary supply chains. And there's the grease is being taken out of them. That always impacts productivity and production. I mean, a really good example was, I read about this, I'm trying to think.
I mean, it's just a great example of the supply chain issues that we have. I mean, there you go. If you put a it's like that meme, you know, where the guy's riding a bicycle and he sticks and he himself puts a stick in his like spokes and he like makes him like fall over. If you put a stick in the spoke of the global liquidity system, just like locking people in a cage and crushing the supply chains, you're going to have less economic activity.
And it's even for things that you want. So, for example, in Nigeria, there was a food manufacturing facility that makes sunflower oil, amongst other things. Mm. Okay, we're in a food crisis, right? There is so fertilizer prices are sky high. There is pretty much all of the commodities within the, whether you take soy, wheat, you know, take all of these over sort of the last 10 years, we're up. These guys had to shut down. Why? Because they couldn't source dollars. They couldn't source dollars to pay dollar debts. And it wasn't because they were unprofitable at the time, right? But it was an inability to source dollars at the price that they needed to. And so these guys, they shut down their factory. So as the financial architecture that's been built over the last 40 years is being used now as a weapon.
Mm.
It's causing this massive contraction that will be solved by the market. That's why I say this is a time where you can have other currency systems come into force purely because they have to, just to try and survive. And in a normal environment, you would look at it and go, no, that's not going to happen. It's too hard. Da, 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 da. Well, it's now a do or die situation. But in that time frame, what happens is you have a massive constriction of productivity and supply of all sorts of goods and services.
And doesn't that get worse through protectionism? Because if you're country XYZ and you're like, okay, we need palm oil as an example, and if we don't have it, then they're going to take me out and give me the guillotine. You know, talking about the politicians, you know, those are my two options. Yeah. So I'm going to make sure that we have it. So I'm going to make it illegal to export any palm oil in the future. Therefore, you're taking palm oil off the global market, that supply. Therefore, the demand is similar. Prices go up. So in addition to everything that you're saying, if these, because commodities become such a... I don't want to use the word necessity because they're already a necessity, but because they become even more valuable above and beyond dollars, then we see the countries making it illegal to export. And then, like I was saying, the supply goes down, price goes up.
Well, just as the West is using the dollar as a financial weapon and credit weapon, what we're likely to see, what you do is you look in your own toolbox and you go, you bastards, what have I got to fight with?
Exactly, right.
And so the tools that each country have in their toolbox are then presented. Whether they use them or not, we don't know.
Yeah, it's like how the Vietnamese fought us in the war.
It's pretty,
right?
Very, very good example. Yeah, yeah. And then the next iteration beyond that, right? Because the first thing that we do in a time of crisis is we hunker down, right? So we go tribal, we go to our own, we know what we, like, if you're a country that has wheat, you're like, okay, well, at least we got wheat, right? We're going to grow our own wheat, but we might need diesel, right? So that's the next step. You're like, okay, well, we got the wheat. We don't want to deal, like, screw everyone else, hunker down. And then you're like, oh, shit. I need diesel. I need to go out now. It's like if you and I were trudging through the forest and we got a little cabin and we brought all our food and then we're like, oh, fuck, we're running out of food. Okay, we need to go and cut some wood. Okay, let's get out, take the axe, go get some wood. And so in the same regional context, what happens is countries will hunker down. That's protectionism. That will increase the cost. It will reduce the flow of goods,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
which itself often can, especially when they're critical elements in terms of you know, what we as humans need to survive, that can bring war, because the only way that you can get it is to go out and get it. And if you have it and your neighbor doesn't, they're going to come to get it if they need to survive.
Yeah, yep.
So you either have conflict in order to settle that difference, or you have an alliance built.
Yeah.
And what we're watching now with the BRICS in particular are these alliances being built, where they're going, okay, I need energy, I need this, I need that. And they're forming alliances which you wouldn't necessarily have seen formed before. It's not necessarily that they have the same ideological approach to something. Some countries have got dictatorships, other ones have quasi-democracies. Some are, you know, you take most of South America, it's Christian, Catholic oriented. You take the Muslim world in the Middle East, it's not, but there is an alliance being formed, you know, rapidly now. I would suspect within the next 18 months, Saudi Arabia is going to join BRICS.
Mm.
It'll stun All right. most people, but that's likely to happen because their military alliances have already been formed with Russia. Okay, so all these that's a good thing. Alliances mean less chance of war, right? Because it's like that old saying, when goods and services don't move across borders, bullets do. Well, we need those goods and services to move across borders so that we don't have bullets moving across borders.
Yeah, but also they're kind of unplugging from the Eurodollar system, which is to say they're unplugging from a system which gives incredibly efficient access to capital and liquidity in the form of those dollars. So if they're unplugging from that, it'd be basically like the United States unplugging from using currency, going back to a barter system. You can think about what we're talking about to economic activity there. It would really slow down until they come up with some other solution. But even if it is the yuan or ruble or whatever you want to plug in, it's not going to have the infrastructure isn't going to be as efficient as allocating liquidity as the Eurodollar system.
That grease, if you will. I like to think of it as grease on an oil or a turbine or something.
Right, right.
You're taking that away. And so it's a very difficult decision to make. So I think that some countries won't make it and they'll choose to go down the IMF World Bank path, which ultimately will destroy and or cause civil unrest within the country. And then others will watch that and go, oh, okay, so that's the result, right? So it's at this point in time, I think the global South is kind of like this football that gets knocked around.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to expand on that point too, Chris, because as I'm thinking it through, those countries that do have to stay on the current system with the euro dollar and using dollars, they are, I mean, it's going to get worse and worse and worse for them from a standpoint of, even if they can access dollars through the IMF, let's say a swap line via the Fed, the things they need those dollars for to buy, those input costs, are going to go up exponentially, but their dollar cash flows are not. So they're going to become more and more and more beholden to the IMF, the Fed, et cetera.
You know what it's like? It's like quicksand.
Yeah, right. There you go. Yep.
You're in it and you realize that you can stay alive for some time if you just kind of don't move too much.
Mm.
But you realize you're still in quicksand. And so do you reach out and get a lifeline? So I can't see an easy way out for them. It has to get worse and potentially much worse, especially when they have a balance of payments crisis, which is coming. That's when the initial decisions will need to be made. How do we step out of this? How do we actually come out of that? You choose the grease that you knew, which is now no longer as greasy as it used to be. It's still, and it's increasingly problematic. It's the quicksand you're diving into. or you choose to go down another path, and that other path is going to be way, way less greasy. it's not going to be as fluid. It's going to be much. It's still being built. In fact, you're part of building it. Yeah. And I mean, it's a little. I think about it like communication. So, Skype. People don't use Skype as much as they used to. But I remember some many years back talking with friends, and everybody used to jump on Skype, and you chat to each other on Skype. And then there were all sorts of different systems that were built with better privacy and so on and so forth. The problem that existed was that you needed to have everyone on them for them to have any real value. You needed to have the network. And so it's like you could have had Viber, or I don't know, Viber, there was a bunch of them. And you'd go, oh, yeah, and you'd set it up, and then you'd, I'd call up George. I'm like, George, you need to get on, blah. And you're like, oh, shit, I got to download it. How did I download it? And they're all clunky. And half the time, it wouldn't work properly. You go, oh, fuck it, just let's get on Skype. And we'd talk to each other on Skype. And so Skype is the equivalent of the euro dollar system. It works, it functions, everyone's used to it. You don't like the fact that there's no privacy maybe on it, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just easy. It functions and it works. And now you're having to build another world with something else. And it only really gains traction when enough participants are on it. And that's kind of the situation where we are today in terms of this financial reconstruction.
And Chris, one more thing to add to the mix here is not only is Skype, not only do they have that network effect, but it's cheap. So where I'm going with that is
cost of credit.
It's the cost of credit. That's right. So sure, you might say if you're country XYZ, I want to side with the BRICS, but then you're going to have to pay. You know, if you need X amount of rubles, you're going to be paying a 10% interest rate on that, as opposed to paying a 2 or 3% interest rate with that dollar system, which is going to make those entities that much more inefficient.
Yeah, you nailed it. You. And so I think what that means from us as from an investment perspective is to expect stagflation.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking it through to try and at least visualize in my head what it looks like. And I came back to, I had a vivid memory when I was 16. I went backpacking up into Africa. I don't know why my parents let me do that, but I wouldn't let my kids do it. But nevertheless, I had some good lessons in that particular trip, including watching someone get stabbed in front of me to death. But what I remember was you had the ability to gain and get products was just really hampered. I stayed with a friend of the family, and they raced out I thought it was the first evening I was there, and the phone call came in, and they're like, oh, quick, we're going. I'm like, where are we going? Oh, no, we've got to go and get rice. I'm like, okay. We jump in the car, we drive off to a particular store to go and get rice. And I didn't really fully understand why there was this massive rush and panic, and everyone had to drop everything in the middle of dinner to go and get some rice. The reason was rice was very hard to get. To come by. And so when a delivery came in, you went and you secured as much of the damn stuff as you could. And I remember them buying bags of bloody rice and putting them in the back of the Land Cruiser. And I'm like, how much rice do you want? And they're like, oh no, we'll give some to friends, and but you can't get rice. And the same is true of spark plugs and all sorts of things. So what you land up doing when you have an inability to get these goods and services that you have become accustomed to, you hoard. It's think of stock and flow. Stock is the shit you got in the back of the cupboard. Flow is where you can continuously get that. We've lived in a world of flow such that stock doesn't matter. It's just in time inventory. You're like, I'll order it. Uber Eats. I mean, it's whatever. And it's not just Uber Eats. It's Uber spark plugs. It's Uber bloody everything. Could just be delivered the drop of a hat, and you didn't have to worry about stocking up. We're moving into a period of time where everybody stocks up, right? That means flow is impacted. And so that's kind of
time too element there. right? Like, let's say that you have 40 hours a week to allocate to being productive as a worker or as an entrepreneur or whatever. Let's just say that 10 of those hours are now allocated to trying to find rice. Well, now you only have 30 hours to be productive, and you just compound that across an entire society, and that impacts GDP big time.
It's huge. It's huge. And so, you know, there's this oft argument between, oh, is it going to be inflation or deflation? And I think we're looking at it completely the wrong way. You need to just go back to first principles and look at how do you function in a society like that? And again, I think the closest I can come to it is what you experience in some of these very poorly run third world countries. You have high amounts of red tape. And you could say, well, you're going to have deflation because there's no real demand for services. True, right? Why? Because people are poor, right? So there's not a huge demand for, I don't know, nail services and sort of frivolous spending.
But not a lot of demand in Venezuela either.
But they're always, and I've never, ever been to any country, and I've traveled to a lot of them, I've never, ever been to any country that operates like that where inflation's low.
That's my point.
Ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
And so you have, and productivity's low. Why? Because there's so much red tape. Corruption is high. Why? Because corruption is a solution to legislative overreach. That's just the reality. And so, I mean, this gets into, you know, many other conversations we could have. But basically,
countries... options are what we just discussed or quicksand.
Yep.
Those are your two options.
Yeah. So the base that we, there are positives to this because what we will see built is a new system or maybe multiple new systems. If we go back in history, what often can happen is you have multiple new systems and then it coalesces over the course of decades into one that basically proves to be the best or most productive or whatever the case might be for whatever reason. Okay. And so we're in that transition phase. That's always chaotic, but it needs to happen. It's going to happen anyway. So you might as well just buckle up and get on with it. But the other thing that is useful in this is that all of these coercive tactics and everything else that are being utilized increasingly become less effective. And the ability to hold them together by the coercive elites, if you will, becomes weakened. And there's an asymmetry here too, because there's two options available to them. When the narrative collapses, you either have to step back and go, okay, we've lost that particular narrative battle and I'm going to get torched in my own building. So maybe I'm going to, you know, step back and
lose the battle, win the war.
Sort of pull back from this, or you go full retard, complete police state. Mm. And I think we're going to see both.
Right, right, right.
So if you look at Europe, which has always been the warring tribal bloody countries, that's what I think we're likely to see. Some countries are just going to go completely full retard, lockdown. They will be unrecognizable. They already are unrecognizable from a few years prior. But over the decade, they will become really unrecognizable. And then others will see that writing on the wall and see the risks in it and go, I don't want to be torched. Mm. And we're going to have to choose. And so it's difficult, of course, at this point in time to know who's going to do what, where, and how, other than to know that it'll be a chaotic period of time where we will have this stagflationary environment. So when we come to allocating our capital and resources, we need to be very cognizant of watching all of these things. While, I mean, like I like to say that it seems obvious as to where we need to be invested in terms of sectors,
right?
But the geographies is probably one of the most difficult things for us to be able to ascertain.
So if that's your global framework, how do you layer over the high probability of recession? Because that's extremely negative for commodity prices. So is it just simply that, like what I'm obviously not as sophisticated as you are from a standpoint of being an investor. So what I'm thinking is, okay, well, you got a couple yield curve inversions, you got negative GDP, you got Atlanta Fed taking GDP forecast down to -2. You got gold going down. You got commodity prices crashing. You've got the 10-year trading at 2.88% roughly. All of this is just screaming recession, which again is negative for commodity prices. So if you're a long-term bull, do you just use that as a buying opportunity, or how are you playing it?
Well, what I looked at, and I wrote about this in one of the issues more recently, was going back and looking at previous recessions and or depressions, and then saying, okay, what happened in those time frames with respect to a portfolio that is similar to that which we have? And so when I say similar, I basically took a very broad 25% breakdown and said, okay, 25% in precious metals, 25% in ag, 25% in base commodities, and 25% in energy energy. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's your kind of commodity portfolio, if you will. And then we looked at like 1929, the late 1960s, 1970s, and then the late 90s. And then I would suggest now sort of like the 2020s is the next one. Right. But if we looked at those three, now they were not like the 1930s was a deflationary one. The 1970s was inflationary, right? But if you took that portfolio in 1929, by 1940, it would have been up, I think it was about 120%. Don't quote me on that. It was 120-something%. Okay. And so remember, that was the Great Depression. And so
that's
the broad
nominal,
stock market
then real would have been higher.
Yeah, I mean, the broad stock market was down by 50%. So it halved roughly over a decade. Holding cash would have given you over that period of time about 20%. Okay. So obviously better than losing 50% in the stock market. But owning a commodity portfolio, you literally look like a genius. And you go, well, there's demand destruction there. 100% there was. When you have demand destruction, like when people stop working, they stop producing.
Yeah. So the bottom line is you have demand destruction, but you have an increased rate of supply destruction.
Yeah. And then you take the 70s, right? So the 70s was quite a different crisis, right? That was an inflationary crisis. And a similar portfolio over that decade would have returned you about 400%, better than the deflationary one from 1929. But remember, there you were 120%.
Is that nominal, though, Chris?
Yes.
Yeah. But still, in adjusted real terms, you're still making a lot of money there.
Well, real rate of inflation from 70 through 80 was about 80%.
Okay.
Yeah. So you were still way ahead. Mm. I mean, like way ahead. And so today we've kind of got.
And what did commodity, I mean, I know this, but just for the viewers, what did the commodities do during the dot-com bust or recession, the slight one we had, and what did they do during the GFC and then shortly thereafter?
In the dot-com bust and you know, because that was one that I traded, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was what, 2000 through. If that portfolio, roughly 25% across all of those, trying to think of the numbers now, it was a 350-360% for the decade.
Through 2000 to 2010.
So if you took 1999, 2000 through to 2010.
Right.
Yeah. And at the same time, broad equities were up, I think, about 30-40% over that time frame, which was poor in terms of purchasing power over the decade. But again, you way, way outperformed.
I think what's interesting those two like recessions. Bonds,
but you think about your risk parity trade, which most people are in, it's kind of, it's in the 60, you've got, I don't know, maybe dependent upon age, 20-30% in growth. And like, you know, that's unfortunately where most people are in. And then the 40%, well, that just looks like a bug in search of a windshield, because these crises periods that we've just been discussing are not the multi-generational, like once in a 100-odd-year event, which I believe we're in.
Yeah.
But even if we were not, even if we were in a more traditional one, like 29, like 70s, like 2000 through 2010, it seems evident to me that that's the safest portfolio that one can have.
Yeah, and I think if my memory serves me right, recession of 2000, 2001, commodities dropped a bit, then screamed higher. Then you get the GFC, commodities drop a bit, scream higher. To when they peaked out, and I think it's like 2011, something like that. Then you go into a bear market, the downside of the super cycle, until call it 2020 when oil was at negative 38. I think that's kind of how it'll play back when we look at this in 20 years or so.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, I know I've kept you a long time here. I want to remind everyone that Chris is one of my amazing partners, along with Lynn Alden with Rebel Capitalist Pro. So if you like this conversation, this is what we do constantly within the forum on the live streams. You can ask people like Chris questions directly, not just on commodities, but specific producers, specific stocks that he likes within the commodity space or whatever it is that he's bullish on. Lynn, the same thing. We got Brent Johnson, Tony Greer, Patrick Sresna, Jason Hartman. So you guys can check that out at georgegammon.com/pro, I believe. And for the others who want to find out more about what you do, Chris, where can they go?
Capitalist Exploits is our publication. And then where we have an asset management company, it's Glenorchy Capital, where we manage private accounts.
All right, brother. Thanks for your time, man. Can't wait to do it always again. That's going to be a fun 10 years, isn't it?
Oh, man. Oh, boy. Yeah.
There's going to be a lot to talk about. That's for sure. That's the upside.
That is for sure. Good chatting.
All right, man. Have a good one. Can't wait to get you out of jail there so we can hang out and have a beer.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.